There is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Yes, welcome, and once again, you are invited to attend to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. This evening, Under Lamplight, I think it's going to be an exclusively American show, with John Steinbeck, Wendell Berry, and, as is our custom, Walt Whitman, with another installment of his Song of Myself. First, let's attend to Steinbeck's masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath. This is a book I used to teach a long time ago to classes of 15-year-olds, and I think I once taught it in England to a class of adults. I've recently been hearing the book read very well by John Chancer, and this has brought it all back to life for me. I've been more impressed than ever with what a moving and important book this is. What a radical book, in fact. I've always ranked Steinbeck among the lighter-weight 20th-century classics, but I'm not so sure now. Steinbeck gets so close to the land and to the people of the land, now kicked off their family farms and trying to stay alive as migrant workers in California. Steinbeck has an eye for the important detail and an ear for the sounds of people's conversations. People, most of us cultured readers, would easily dismiss as illiterate nobodies, hardly worth our attention. Once we're caught up in the book, though, we can never again dismiss these people or any dispossessed migrant workers. Our heart is open, our imagination broadened, and what more can we ask from any book? In particular, Steinbeck is clearly aware of the injustices carried out by the power establishment in America, unjust in the late 1930s, when the novel is set, and even more unjust today. This makes it worth our reconsidering the book in our own time. But wait, before we go further with Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, well, let's pause a minute to consider the title. Grapes of Wrath, as I suppose all Americans must know, or used to know, comes from the Battle Hymn of the Republic, a solemn but triumphalist song from the American Civil War, belonging to the God is on our side genre. It's based on an image from Revelation 19, describing the King of Kings and Lord of Lords leading armies, and out of his mouth goeth a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. When he says he's going to smite the nations, I think we're to take nations to mean the others, those who are not us. This is one of the exclusivist passages from the Bible, dividing the world into us and them, not like, say, the end of the book of Jonah or the parable of the prodigal son, recognizing the unity of all people. And of course, an us-them vision of the world always has them as being the ones who are in the wrong. God is always on our side. That goes without saying. Here's the first stanza of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. The Republic, of course, being us. In this case, the North in the Civil War. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He has trampled out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Can you catch the biblical imagery? God is arriving in his glory to do what? What is he doing by tramping out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored? Are we to picture God as some kind of vintner who gathers his harvest of grapes and then tramples them in the big vats to produce his wine? The grapes represent God's wrath, which has been growing all season and is now harvested and pressed down into heady wine, God's vintage. The grapes are the anger, and the wine coming from the grapes is his retribution, trampling down on the unjust southern adherents of slavery till their blood runs like wine. Is this what you think when you hear the song? I suspect the image was quite alive to the first wartime readers of this poem by Julia Ward Howe, an anti-slavery campaigner before and during the Civil War. And then comes the second image, as God looses the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. Like the mythological Zeus, so this biblical myth shows lightning as the sign of heaven's wrath towards earth. It's fateful lightning. Man, it was your fate, your doom, that brought this terrible swift destruction upon you. There's no stopping God's truth. It is marching on. That's a very stirring poem and an even more stirring song when well sung, and sung it is well here by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. But I think many of us today would turn away from this quick association that the destruction of our enemies is a sign that God is on our side. We've seen enough of this, and we know that whatever truth is marching on, it's not God's truth, unless it comes in the spirit of compassion, peace, and reconciliation. Even in a war to liberate slaves, though the Civil War was more than that, even in such a war, we must be careful not to demonize our enemies as a harvest of anger God is going to stomp on. But why does John Steinbeck choose Grapes of Wrath for the title of his novel? I said just a minute ago that the book is radical. Steinbeck has his eye on the bitter grapes of the unjust economic and social conditions that have driven the Oklahoma farmers off their land. He never shows these grapes of wrath being trampled into bloody retribution, but he keeps hinting through the book that if ever the people's anger grows strong enough for them to unite into a common cause, they will topple the people in power. He wouldn't go so far as to call this God's terrible swift sword. His religious statements in the book are less sure of themselves, the more tentative. But he knows that the truth lies in treating people like people, not ciphers or machines. And this truth is marching on, whether we're aware of it or not. Allow me to share with you a few readings from the earlier chapters of the book. The first passage is, in fact, the opening paragraphs of the book, introducing the Dust Bowl disaster to the reader. Steinbeck studied the way Oklahoma cornfields were depleted by the already poor land, so that after a long drought had turned the land into a crust of dry earth, the wind lifted the dust and filled the air with it, ruining whatever crops were left after the drought. Attend, if you can, to Steinbeck's clear prose and sharp images as he condenses several months of agricultural history into this brief account. To the red country and part of the gray country of Oklahoma, the last rains came gently, and they did not cut the scarred earth. The plows crossed and recrossed the rivulet marks. The last rains lifted the corn quickly and scattered weed colonies and grass along the sides of the roads, so that the gray country and the dark red country began to disappear under a green cover. In the last part of May, the sky grew pale, and the clouds that had hung in high puffs for so long in the spring were dissipated. The sun flared down on the growing corn day after day, until a line of brown spread along the edge of each green bayonet. The clouds appeared and went away, and in a while they did not try any more. The weeds grew darker green to protect themselves, and they did not spread any more. The surface of the earth crusted, a thin, hard crust, and as the sky became pale, so the earth became pale, pink in the red country and white in the gray country. In the water-cut gullies, the earth dusted down in dry little streams. Gophers and ant lions started small avalanches. And as the sharp sun struck day after day, the leaves of the young corn became less stiff and erect. They bent in a curve at first, and then, as the central ribs of strength grew weak, each leaf tilted downward. Then it was June, and the sun shone more fiercely. The brown lines on the corn leaves widened and moved in on the central ribs. The weeds frayed and edged back toward their roots. The air was thin and the sky more pale, and every day the earth paled. In the roads where the teams moved, where the wheels milled the ground and the hooves of the horses beat the ground, the dirt crust broke and the dust formed. Every moving thing lifted the dust into the air. A walking man lifted a thin layer as high as his waist, and a wagon lifted the dust as high as the fence, and an automobile boiled a cloud behind it. The dust was as long in settling back again. When June was half gone, the big clouds moved up out of Texas and the Gulf. High, heavy clouds, rain heads. The men in the fields looked up at the clouds and sniffed at them and held wet fingers up to sense the wind, and the horses were nervous while the clouds were up. The rain heads dropped a little, splattering, and hurried on to some other country. Behind them the sky was pale again, and the sun flared. In the dust there were drop craters where the rain had fallen, and there were clean splashes on the corn, and that was all. A gentle wind followed the rain clouds, driving them on northward, a wind that softly clashed the drying corn. A day went by, and the wind increased steadily by unbroken gusts. The dust from the roads fluffed up and spread out and fell on the weeds beside the fields and fell into the fields a little way. Now the wind grew strong and hard, and it worked at the rain crust in the cornfields. Little by little the sky was darkened by the mixing dust, and the wind felt over the earth, loosened the dust, and carried it away. The wind grew stronger, the rain crust broke, and the dust lifted up out of the fields and drove gray plumes into the air like sluggish smoke. The corn threshed the wind and made a dry, rusting sound. The finest dust did not settle back to earth now, but disappeared into the darkening sky. The wind grew stronger, whisked under stones, carried up straws and old leaves, and even little clods, marking its course as it sailed across the fields. The air and the sky darkened, and through them the sun shone redly, and there was a raw sting in the air. During the night, the wind raced faster over the land, dug cunningly among the rootlets of the corn, and the corn fought the wind with its weakened leaves until the roots were freed by the prying wind, and then each stalk settled wearily sideways toward the earth and pointed the direction of the wind. The dawn came, but no day. In the gray sky, a red sun appeared, a dim red circle that gave a little light, like dusk. And as that day advanced, the dusk slipped back toward darkness, and the wind cried and whimpered over the fallen corn.
On the 14th day of April of 1935, there struck the worst of dust storms that ever filled the sky. You could see that dust storm coming, the cloud looked death-like black, and through our mighty nation it left a dreadful track. From Oklahoma City to the Arizona line, Dakota and Nebraska to the lazy Rio Grande, it fell across our city like a curtain of black roll down. We thought it was our judgment, we thought it was our doom. The radio reported, we listened with alarm, the wild and windy actions of this great mysterious storm. From Albuquerque and Clovis and all New Mexico, they said it was the blackest that ever they had saw. From Old Arch City, Kansas, the dust had rung their knell, and a few more comrades sleeping on top of Old Boot Hill. From Denver, Colorado, they said it blew so strong, they thought that they could hold out, but they didn't know how long. Our relatives were huddled into their oil boom shacks, and the children, they was crying as it whistled through the cracks. And the family, it was crowded into their little room. They thought the world had ended, and they thought it was their doom. Storm took place at sundown, it lasted through the night. When we looked out next morning, we saw a terrible sight. We saw outside our window where wheat fields they had grown was now a rippling ocean of dust the wind had blown. It covered up our fences, it covered up our barns, it covered up our tractors in this wild and dusty storm. We loaded our jalopies and piled our families in. We rattled down that highway to never come back again.
That was Woody Guthrie, of course, the other great recorder of the great dust storm disaster of the 1930s. I want to read something now a few pages further in the book. Usually in The Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck alternates between short chapters that give a generalized view of the agricultural, social, economic conditions in which the story is set, and the more particularized drama of the Joad family, whom we follow from tenant farmer in Oklahoma, to migrant workers in California. Here are some paragraphs from the chapter describing the way Oklahoma tenant farmers were thrown off the land they lived on for generations, dispossessed by the banks, which foreclosed on the loans the farmers had to take out in years of bad harvests. Watching these helpless human beings caught in larger economic forces they cannot understand or control opens our eyes and hearts to those people from 75 years ago. And it may also, such is the power of literature, it may also open our eyes and hearts to the plight of so many people in our world today, both at home and abroad. Chapter 5. The owners of the land came onto the land, or more often a spokesman for the owners came. They came in closed cars, and they felt the dry earth with their fingers, and sometimes they drove big earth augers into the ground for soil tests. The tenants, from their sun-beaten dooryards, watched uneasily when the closed cars drove along the fields. And at last the owner men drove into the dooryards and sat in their cars to talk out of the windows. The tenant men stood beside the cars for a while and then squatted on their hams and found sticks with which to mark the dust. In the open doors, the women stood looking out, and behind them the children, corn-headed children, with wide eyes, one barefoot on top of the other barefoot, and the toes working. The women and their children watched their men talking to the owner men. They were silent. Some of the owner men were kind because they hated what they had to do, and some of them were angry because they hated to be cruel, and some of them were cold because they had long ago found that one could not be an owner unless one were cold. And all of them were caught in something larger than themselves. Some of them hated the mathematics that drove them, and some were afraid, and some worshipped the mathematics because it provided a refuge from thought and from feeling. If a bank or a finance company owned the land, the owner man said, the bank or the company needs, wants, insists, must have, as though the bank or the company were a monster with thought and feeling which had ensnared them. These last would take no responsibility for the banks or the companies because they were men and slaves, while the banks were machines and masters all at the same time. Some of the owner men were a little proud to be slaves to such cold and powerful masters. The owner men sat in the cars and explained, "You know the land is poor. You've scrabbled it all along, God knows." The squatting tenant men nodded and wondered and drew figures in the dust, and yes, they knew. God knows. If the dust only wouldn't fly, if the top would only stay on the soil, why, it might not be so bad. The owner men went on leading to their point. You know the land's getting poorer. You know what cotton does to the land, robs it, sucks all the blood out of it. The squatters nodded. They knew. They knew, God knew. If they could only rotate the crops, they might pump blood back into the land. Yeah, well, it's too late, and the owner men explained the workings and the thinkings of the monster that was stronger than they were. A man can hold land if he can just eat and pay taxes. He can do that. Yes, he can do that until his crops fail one day and he has to borrow money from the bank. But, you see, a bank or a company can't do that, because these creatures don't breathe air, don't need side meat. They breathe profits. They eat the interest on money. If they don't get it, they die the way you die, without air, without side meat. It's a sad thing, but it is so. It just is so. The squatting men raised their eyes to understand. Well, can't we just hang on? Maybe the next year will be a good year. God knows how much cotton next year, and with all the wars, God knows what price cotton will bring. Don't they make explosives out of cotton and uniforms? get enough wars and cotton will hit the ceiling. Next year, maybe. They looked up questioningly. We can't depend on it. The bank, the monster, has to have profits all the time. It can't wait. It'll die. No taxes go on. When the monster stops growing, it dies. It can't stay one size. Soft fingers began to tap the sill of the car window, and hard fingers tightened on the restless drawing sticks. In the doorways of the sun-beaten tenant houses, women sighed and then shifted feet so that the one that had been down was now on top and the toes working. Dogs came sniffing near the owner cars and wetted on all the four tires one after another. And chickens lay in the sunny dust and fluffed their feathers to get the cleansing dust down to the skin. In the little sties, the pigs grunted inquiringly over the muddy remnants of the slops. The squatting men looked down again. Oh, well, what do you want us to do? We can't take less share of the crop. We're half starved now. The kids are hungry all the time. We got no clothes, torn and ragged. If all the neighbors weren't the same, we'd be ashamed to go to meeting. And at last the owner men came to the point. The tenant system won't work anymore. One man on a tractor can take the place of 12 or 14 families, pay him a wage and take all the crop. We have to do it. We don't like to do it, but the monster's sick. Something's happened to the monster. But you'll kill the land with cotton. Yeah, we know. We've got to take cotton quick before the land dies. And then we'll sell the land. Lots of families in the East would like to own a piece of land. The tenant men looked up alarmed. But what'll happen to us? How we eat? Now, you'll have to get off the land. The plows will go through the dooryard. And now the squatting men stood up angrily. Grandpa took the land, and he had to kill the Indians and drive them away. And Pa was born here, and he killed weeds and snakes. Then a bad year came, and he had to borrow a little money. And we was born here. There in the door, our children born here. And Pa had to borrow money. The bank owned the land then, but we stayed, and we got a little bit of what we raised. We know that, all that. It's not us, it's the bank. A bank isn't like a man. Or an owner with 50,000 acres, he isn't like a man either. That's the monster. Sure, cried the tenant men, but it's our land. We measured it and broke it up. We were born on it, and we got killed on it and died on it. Even if it's no good, it's still ours. That's what makes it ours, being born on it, working on it, dying on it. That makes ownership, not a paper with numbers on it. We're sorry, it's not us. It's the monster. The bank isn't like a man. Yeah, but the bank is only made of men. No, you're wrong there, quite wrong there. The bank is something else than men. It happens that every man in a bank hates what the bank does, and yet the bank does it. The bank is something more than men, I tell you. It's the monster. Men made it, but they can't control it.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. was a farming on the shares, and always I was poor. My crops I lay into the banker's store. My wife took down and died up on the cabin floor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Now as I look around, it's mighty plain to see, this world is such a great and a funny place to be. All the gambling man is rich and the working man is poor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
What better accompaniment to the Grapes of Wrath than these songs from Woody Guthrie, who was right there, observing, talking to the people, and bringing this whole experience to us through his songs, in particular his first album in 1940, Dust Bowl Ballads. What is going on in this world where machines take over from human beings? Casey, the ex-preacher in the Grapes of Wrath, the spokesman for Steinbeck's views, cannot really figure things out. He observes and ponders and knows something's wrong, but he can't work it out. Someone who could work it out, though, was Wendell Berry, writing in 1988, combining an academic's analysis with a small farmer's understanding of how it feels for the people on the land, losers in the corporative monster's takeover of agriculture on a much larger scale in the Reagan years than ever the poor Okies could have imagined 50 years earlier. If you would welcome a little more of being read to, I'd like to share with you a few paragraphs from Berry's essay, Economy and Pleasure. To those who still uphold the traditions of religious and political thought that influenced the shaping of our society and the founding of our government, it is astonishing and, of course, discouraging to see economics now elevated to the position of ultimate justifier and explainer of all the affairs of our daily life, and competition enshrined as the sovereign principle and ideal of economics. As thousands of small farms and small local businesses of all kinds falter and fail under the effects of adverse economic policies, or live under the threat of what we complacently call scientific progress, the economist sits in the column of professorial tenure and government subsidy, commenting and explaining for the illumination of the press and the general public. If those who fail happen to be fellow humans, neighbors, children of God, and citizens of the Republic, all that is outside the purview of the economist. As the farmers go under, as communities lose their economic supports, as all of rural America sits as if condemned in the shadow of the free market and revolutionary science, the economist announces pontifically to the press that there will be some winners and some losers, as if that might justify and clarify everything or anything. The sciences, one gathers, mindlessly serve economics, and the humanities defer abjectly to the sciences. All assume, apparently, that we are in the grip of the determination of economic laws that are the laws of the universe. The newspapers quote the economists as the ultimate authorities. We read their pronouncements, knowing that the last word has been said. Science, President Reagan says, tells us that the breakthroughs in superconductivity bring us to the threshold of a new age. He is speaking to a federal conference on the commercial applications of the new technology, and we know that by science, he means scientists in the pay of corporations. It is our task at this conference, he says, to herald in that new age with a rush. A part of his program to accomplish this task is a proposal to relax the antitrust laws, Thus, even the national executive and our legal system itself must now defer to the demands of the economy. Whatever new age is at hand at the moment must be hurled in with a rush because of the profits available to those who will rush it in. It seems that we have been reduced almost to a state of absolute economics, in which people and all other creatures and things may be considered purely as economic units or integers of production, and in which a human being may be dealt with, as John Ruskin put it, merely as a covetous machine. And the voices bitterest to hear are those saying that all this destructive work of mindless genius, money, and power is regrettable but cannot be helped. But of course, Berry does think it can be helped. We need to resist and oppose our society's adoration of competitiveness and success as the highest goals. Yes, we need some competitiveness, but community thrives, Berry insists, not by competition, but by mutual help and cooperation. It is impossible, Berry says, not to notice how little proponents of the ideal of competition have to say about honesty, which is the fundamental economic virtue, and how very little they have to say about community, compassion, and mutual help. And it is community, or soul, as Berry quotes John Ruskin as saying, that offers us any deep, lasting, universally beneficial alternative. And the way to bring our soul into our work is by judging our work by the amount of pleasure it gives us. But, well, that's a complicated part of Berry's argument, and in fact we've already spoken about it in a previous Lamplight show. But I've taken some time to attend to Berry, to Wendell Berry, not just because he helps us understand what Steinbeck was bearing witness to in the 1930s, but because he also helps us to see what is going on in our own time. The 1930s Dust Bowl, the 1980s Reaganomics, and the 20-teens accumulation of wealth in the hands of the 1%, our little historical study here shows us how long this dehumanization of our world has been going on, and what an accumulation of wrathful grapes are waiting to be trampled. Okay, so I said our soul is our only way through this appalling and unjust social and economic dehumanization. But what do we mean by soul? Ha ha! I think I know where we can go to see further into this. Our man for this is Walt Whitman, and just in time for this week's meditation of Whitman's Song of Myself takes us to the heart of his understanding of soul. Let's start off reading part 4 of Song of Myself. Trippers and askers surround me, people I meet, the effect upon me of my early life, of the ward and city I live in, of the nation, the latest news, discoveries, inventions, societies, authors old and new, my dinner, dress, associates, looks, business, compliments, dues, the real or fancied indifference of some man or woman I love, the sickness of one of my folks, or of myself, or ill-doing, or loss, or lack of money, or depressions, or exaltations. They come to me days and nights and go from me again, but they are not the me myself. Apart from the pulling and hauling stands what I am, stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary, looks down, is erect, bends an arm on an impalpable certain rest, looks with its side-curved head, curious what will come next, both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. Backward I see in my own days where I sweated through fog with linguists and contenders. I have no mockings or arguments. I witness and wait. Those are some tough lines, and I hope, I really do hope, that I can help you see something in it and make them come alive for you. One way to understand what Whitman is talking about here is to speak of our true self and our false self. The true self is what Whitman is calling the me, myself, or soul. It is our true self that unites us with all things, but we cannot analyze it. We can hardly even put it into words. We just experience it in our heart, below the verbal level. It is a mystery. To elaborate is no avail, Whitman said in the previous section. I and this mystery, here we stand. The false self is what we sometimes call the ego, our conscious self that analyzes and tries to control things. There's nothing wrong with this as long as we realize that this ego does not define our true self, our true identity. Whitman comes up with another catalogue now, this time listing all those people and things around me asking for my engagement, and I can engage with them. In fact, this engagement is the extent of most people's lives. But this engagement, he insists, does not define my true identity. There are trippers and askers all around me, people passing through on their way elsewhere, people stopping me to ask for directions. In other words, all those who just come and go in my life. My engagement with them, though useful and pleasant, does not define my true self. Nor is the effect upon me of my early life, despite what our psychological sophistication tells us today. You know, that time my teacher told me I couldn't write, and as a consequence, I've never had any confidence in my writing or speaking abilities. This past event may indeed have shaped my present life, but it hasn't shaped my true identity, my soul, which exists independently of any skill or lack of skill. Nor can politics affect my true self. All the current events and news reports of the ward and city I live in, of the nation, even the very serious items like reports of wars or investigations into unjust employment practices or oppressive social programs, these, serious as they are, do not define me. The same applies to news about scientific breakthroughs and technological advances. Hey, what about that latest smartphone? Hey, I'm going to look into these new methods of extracting solar power. Wonderful. But don't confuse that with who you really are. You are not the latest technology you've just bought. Even though people now think you must be someone really important because you have a new expensive car, your true identity is still the same as it was when you were driving that 15-year-old Ford. Oh, you've been invited to a book launch at Oxford University Press. Oh, it's your new book that's being launched. You've had good reviews? Great. Oh, bad reviews? Too bad. But you know our refrain. Don't confuse these things with who you really are. Oh, I love the way you dress. You always look so elegant, and I'm really impressed with the number of sexy / powerful / celebrity people you hang around with. What? You met the Dalai Lama and he told you he was pleased to see the work you've been doing with the homeless people? Take it all in your stride, man. Don't hold on to it. Let it go. It's just attached to your ego self. Your true self is deeper than even all this. And then Whitman throws us a tough one. The real or fancied indifference of some man or woman I love. She means a lot to me. I really put myself out to find her a present I thought she'd like, and I could tell by the way she unwrapped the present that it didn't really matter to her what I gave her. I was hurt to my very core. Well, actually, no, you weren't hurt to your very core. It was just your ego that was hurt. And notice that it doesn't seem to matter whether your beloved's indifference was real or imagined. Neither kind of indifference defines your true identity. This reminds me of a disturbing thing I read a few years ago. A gay priest in the American Episcopal Church was lamenting that the church did not recognize his homosexuality as a valid kind of love. It did not allow him to marry his lover. He complained that in taking this view, the church was denying his very essence. I wonder what he would have made of this passage from Whitman. Not having his sexual preferences recognized by the church and not having the church support the kind of deep relationship he wanted to have with his lover, this is, of course, hurtful. We would be cruel and complicit in the church's discrimination if we quickly dismissed this priest's pain. But I think the priest was wrong to say this attacked him in his very essence. This was not his soul. Our true selves are not defined by our sexuality, important as that sexuality is for our fulfillment and well-being. You get the point. I'm just trying to bring Whitman's lines to life here. Whitman is stripping away all these aspects of our lives, not dismissing them, but stripping them away. They are what the older philosophers would call accidental features of our lives, not essential features. They even include the sickness of one of my folks, or of myself. I may have cancer, but I'm still me. Or ill-doing. That is, even if I commit murder, I am still not redefining my essential self. Or loss or lack of money, or depressions or exaltations. They come to me days and nights and go from me again, but they are not the me myself. This breathless catalogue, listing one thing after another, with no resolution, building the tension until Whitman comes to that abrupt stop, dismissing that whole list, but they are not the me myself. So what is the me myself? In a beautiful five-line sequence, Whitman gives us a picture of what our true self, our soul, is. Our soul stands back and apart from the pulling and hauling. Pulling and hauling describes the life of the ego, just pulling and hauling, just moving things around. The soul does not reject the pulling and hauling. It just stands back from it, observing and appreciating. We sometimes call this aesthetic distance, letting go of our need to judge and compare and just being open to what lies in front of us, in a work of art, in a person we like, in a person we don't like, in a meal on the table before us, in the weather as we step outside. We see it for itself, not for what it can do for us. You know, I hope that this way of looking at things is what we're doing here, you and I, this evening, under lamplight, when, as T.S. Eliot says, love is most nearly itself. And here's what our soul does, as Whitman gives us another brief catalogue of five adjectives. The soul, the true self, stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary. Amused because it sees the incongruities. That woman walking on the street looking so self-possessed and chic, but so caught up on whatever's on her iPhone screen that she's about to collide with someone. Those teenage boys going past me, leaving behind a reek of cheap, macho aftershave. Poor things, trying so hard to be cool. Even that older woman I saw today in an SUV who opened the window and furiously shouted at some people for having walked in front of her car, preventing her from getting across the intersection when she wanted. The incongruity of her rage with what was, from my point of view at least, a pretty trivial inconvenience. Notice that I'm not amused at her, but at the incongruity. I can also at the same time feel sorry for her. But I must not condemn her. Then my ego comes back into play and I'm being pulled and hauled by what I'm observing. The soul also, Whitman says, stands there complacent. Now this isn't complacent in the sense of smug, but in the sense of being at peace, not needy, not having to judge others or see what I can get from them. Hey, you're an attractive person, but my soul does not desire to possess you, to have you. The soul enjoys you. I stand back, even as I am engaged with you, and admire you for who you are, for the elegant way you carry yourself, or ideally, for the beauty of your own soul, if I'm sensitive enough to be able to be open to that. I am complacent. I am grounded where I am, pleased with where I am, since, after all, I can be nowhere else, right? And compassionating, obviously. If I dare to open myself to all I see, I must necessarily have compassion for everything. My heart goes out to everything, everyone. The soul is idle. Remember the pose with which Whitman opens the poem. I lean and loaf at my ease. I may be busily active, say, practicing the piano or planting new seeds in the garden, but my soul is standing back from that activity, looking on from a distance, idle. And finally, the soul is unitary. It is both united within, everything balanced, and it is united to everything outside. The soul does not see us, them. It sees us all as one. Like some sort of football chant or some sort of airline slogan, its motto is Go United. What else does the soul do? Well, it looks down, is erect. A modern reader might get the picture of Whitman looking down at himself and getting sexually aroused. That would complicate things now, wouldn't it? But as far as I can discover, the word erect was not used in its sexual sense until the end of the 19th century, that is, 50 years after Whitman wrote Song of Myself. So let's rule that out. Erect is the opposite of looking down. I notice what is going on at ground level. I notice what I'm walking on or walking over. But I am also erect, back straight, but more important, my mind looking upwards, alert, attentive, curious. This is poetry, remember, and here we have an oxymoron. I am both looking down and looking up, grounded and open to what's going on. And my soul is also doing something else, something a bit startling. It bends an arm on an impalpable, certain rest. I once spent the whole journey on the underground from King's Cross to Heathrow pondering that line. This is part of my pose as an idle bystander, leaning and loafing at my ease, my arm casually bent as I lean against some rock or shelf or piece of furniture. But in this case, it's an impalpable rock, shelf, or piece of furniture. It's not something anyone can actually touch, and yet it's certain. That's the soul for you. It gains its strength and assurance from knowing, even without actually being able to feel it, that there is something sure and reliable supporting it, enabling the soul to stand at its ease and be alert without worrying about its own safety. The soul looks with... I love this. It's a great image. And the soul looks with its side-curved head, curious what will come next. A side-curved head? Whitman often challenges us with unexpected words. The head is tilted to the side. I think technically it's the neck that's curved. But the effect is to see the head curved sideways in a position of curiosity and openness. It's the attitude described in one of the Latin psalms as expectans expectavi, expectantly I expected, or more loosely, looking outward, I waited for what would come next. And I think if we take up that attitude, we cannot help having a twinkle in our eye, a good indication that we are living in our soul at that moment. This position is summed up by saying we are both in and out of the game. We are not hermits refusing to play the game, but we are both players and spectators. As we engage in everyday life, we are also able at times to step back and be a witness of what is going on at the same time as we are part of what's going on, watching and wondering at it. Can I sustain this? No. Whitman says, backward I see in my own days where I sweated through a fog with linguists and contenders. All of a sudden, I come to myself and realize that instead of being grounded and open, I've been sweating through a fog, not mindful, with linguists, all these voices in my head, and contenders, all these arguments and plans in my head. I thought my soul was engaged in my conversation with my friend at lunch, but I look back on the past few minutes and notice that I've been planning what I'm going to say after my friend stops talking, or I've been silently criticizing how my friend is so slouched on the chair, or worse, I've been conducting an imaginary conversation with that person I've noticed over there on the other side of the room. All these linguists and contenders fogging up my mind, pulling and hauling me back to the ego state, losing my grounding in my soul. Well, that's how it goes. I don't fuss or criticize myself for lapsing back to my ego self. I have no mockings or arguments, as Whitman puts it. I witness and wait. I treat myself kindly and just try again. And oddly enough, if we read what the guides tell us about meditation and contemplative mind, we discover the same thing. The secret of meditation is to relax into the moment. And when we become aware that we've left the moment, as inevitably happens several times a minute, we don't see this as a fault, but we witness and watch ourselves, amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, and unitary, and return to the moment once more. Well, that was quite a little trip through Whitman, following from Steinbeck and Wendell Berry. Chock full of nuts this week under lamplight. And before we go, enough of discourse. Let's return to the poetry and engage with Whitman himself to close our time with him. Trippers and askers surround me, people I meet, the effect upon me of my early life, of the ward and city I live in, of the nation, the latest news, discoveries, inventions, societies, authors old and new, my dinner, dress, associates, looks, business, compliments, dues, the real or fancied indifference of some man or woman I love, the sickness of one of my folks or of myself, or ill-doing, or loss or lack of money, or depressions or exaltations. They come to me days and nights and go from me again, but they are not the me myself. Apart from the pulling and hauling stands what I am, stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary, looks down, is erect, bends an arm on an impalpable, certain rest, looks with its side-curved head, curious what will come next, both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. Backward I see in my own days, where I sweated through a fog with linguists and contenders. I have no mockings or arguments. I witness and wait. And this has been Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. See you again next time.